Good. Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen. It's February 7th, 2018. And this year, I'm wanting to go through how to cultivate, how to develop 12 fundamental inner resources, call them inner strengths, that are related to moving from what I think of as the fundamental fulcrum in Buddhism, from the second noble truth of the craving that creates suffering, to a mind in which we feel increasingly at ease and at rest with a sense of resilient well-being, obviously related to my book, resilient well-being, or as the Buddha called it, equanimity, so that we meet the next moment already feeling full, already feeling stable, already feeling at peace, calm strength, already feeling contented, already feeling loved and loving. How do we grow the factors of that? So this year I'm working through 12 fundamental factors, inner strengths. Coincidentally, they're 12 months in a year. Gee, what a coincidence. The first one was compassion, in particular for yourself, because if you don't have a sense of being on your own side and being moved by your own suffering and your own difficulties and caring about your own dreams, there's no basis for growth or healing or development or movement toward awakening at all. So we started with compassion. In this month, February, I want to talk about mindfulness. That's the second of the 12 strengths in my sequence. And in particular tonight, I want to talk about using mindfulness, which for the Buddha was always a means to an end. In many ways in America and the West these days, mindfulness has become a kind of end in itself, a sort of magic carpet, just be mindful. It'll all work out. These are not really the droids you're looking for. It's just be mindful, it's all okay. And yet for the Buddha, mindfulness was a means to an end. It was a means to the end of liberation and becoming more peaceful and kind and caring with other people. So one of the major applications of mindfulness is to recognize three fundamental characteristics he taught of existence. Not to get an A in philosophy class, but to see the way it is, and in that seeing, become increasingly autonomous, free, happy, and at peace. That's the point. So what were those three characteristics? So that's what I'm going to talk about a bit, and then as usual, open it up for discussion. In these talks through this year, I'm going to always try to usually drop in something experiential in the actual talk portion, give you a feeling for it, but we already did that in the guided meditation. And if I worked the microphone properly, I recorded the meditation, and it'll be posted on my website, and you can listen to it. So the first characteristic, which the Buddha said was in a sense the most fundamental one, because out of it grow the other two, it's the characteristic of existence of impermanence. Transience, change, dynamism, both inside our own mind and out in the world. It seems kind of obvious, but because it's so obvious, we tend to take it for granted. This is the characteristic in Pali of anicca. Nicca means stability or permanence, fixity. Ah means not, so anicca, the absence of nicca, of permanence, impermanence. What's interesting is that when you look closely at your own experience, especially if your mind is relatively quiet, so there's a stability, you can just recognize that I liken consciousness to the surface of a glass of soda water in slow motion. So if you're looking this way, you can see all these bubbles, many of them each per second. In a single second, many thoughts, sensations, dynamic processes, feelings, reactions, plans. In a single second, aspects of hearing, you're hearing sounds right now, so much can happen in 1 second. So many bubbles, pop, 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 popping. And then they interact with each other as these little bubbles of thought or feeling or sensation, desire. they bump into each other, ripples spread. Those two are dynamic and continuously changing. So looking at the emerging field of consciousness is like looking at the surface of a bottle of fizzy water. On the other hand, if we shift out of that so-called first-person perspective, where we're looking at our experience, and we move, step back into a third-person perspective, where we look at our bodies, especially our nervous systems and brains, and we think, where do all those bubbles come from? What seems to be shaping them? Upon which underlying causes are they dependently arising? So then we shift from this view, the first-person view of the glass of soda water, to the third-person view, where we can see the bubbles in real time starting to come up in underlying physical processes that are not yet conscious, and then cross the water line and move into awareness continuously. So you can really see that. And the quieter the mind gets, the more noisy and busy the ordinary mind is by contrast. And also, the quieter and steadier your mind gets, you become more and more able to track events in fractions of a second. You can see so much happening in 1 second. And as you get really quiet, like on a meditation retreat or perhaps being in wilderness for an extended period of time, it can become almost alarming as you start to really recognize the passing awayness of experience. Kind of, people report being really unnerved by it. It's kind of frightening almost. And it's helpful to remind yourself that for all the passing away, there is also arising, certainly as long as this body endures. Okay? Related to the fundamental transience of experience, the stream of consciousness, is an understanding that's like a third-person understanding of the endless processes of change in physical reality. And with modern science now and modern biology, we have a sense increasingly of the extraordinary dynamic and rapid processes of change in our metabolism. I don't know the exact number, but in every second, thousands and thousands of cells are dying or being born. There's an ongoing process of exchange of the atoms in our body with the larger world, so that over a period of years, we are literally, physically at least, very little the person we once were, perhaps eventually not at all. And then this body clearly is embedded in larger processes of physical change, the seasons, the cycles of the day, other people moving about, talking with us, doing various things. And then if you really want to get way out there, which of course I do, and I think it's amazing, you can start to become increasingly aware of how even the fabric of space-time, the fabric of reality, is kind of quivering and vibrating. And as you may have known in the news recently, were two observations, the first of two black holes colliding, and the second, two neutron stars colliding in galaxies ballpark, I think, about 100 million light years away, which meant 100 million or so years ago, these events occurred. And with modern super-sensitive detectors, these events were detected in terms of sending out ripples of gravitational waves, which means, in a sense, it was kind of like as that wave rippled through Earth over a duration of less than a second, it's like reality stretched, and then kind of came back together again. Like, whoa. Right, these changes are happening continuously, all right? And I think it's useful to recognize, actually, that there are certain things that are permanent. But there's so few, the impermanence of everything else becomes starker and more obvious. For example, it appears to be permanently the case that the area of a circle on a flat plane is pi times the radius squared. That seems right true. Impermanence is permanently the case, in a sense. That which has happened will always have happened. There are certain things that you know, do seem to endure in certain ways. To the extent that something is true, it's true tomorrow. If it's true today, it's true tomorrow as a fundamental kind of truth. But other than those exceptions, we're surrounded by impermanence. The implication of that is actually very profound, because it means that to the extent that we base our happiness on the presumption of solidity and stability, particularly in our phenomenology, our experiencing, the stability of a thought or a feeling or a pleasure or a sense an experience of being with another person, to the extent that we base our happiness on changing conditions, well, we're going to be unhappy because conditions will change. And in particular, if we try to stop the river, if we try to stop the process of change, that's doomed. It's frustrating. It's tense. It's contracted, and you can feel it. So as the Buddha taught, more and more radically, as we recognize transience, we get more and more able and more in real time, right at the front edge of now, to keep letting go, keep letting go. Let the river flow, let the river flow, let the river flow. There are questions that naturally arise around, well, how do you sustain intentions towards something? Or how do you cultivate qualities that are relatively stable, like growing compassion or growing mindfulness or growing insight? How do you actually do that? I want to explore that at another time. I'm covering these three fundamental characteristics fairly briskly tonight. The fundamental takeaway is that if we let things change and we relax the habit of clinging or attachment, we can notice directly in our experience that we start feeling more at ease, less stressed, less tense, less collateral damage. We start becoming happier. That's mindfulness of the first characteristic of existence. Right. Second characteristic of existence, dukkha, suffering. Suffering's probably not the world's best translation of that word. It has multiple implications. Basically, dukkha refers to unsatisfactoriness, a sense that it also refers to ordinary pain, ordinary upset, ordinary sadness, anxiety, irritation, wrangles with other people. A lot of what dukkha refers to is the fact not so much that life is inherently unsatisfying, but that any experience is incapable of reliable, enduring fulfillment because it's transient, endlessly ending. That's the fundamental idea. And what's interesting from a sort of neurobiological evolutionary standpoint is to recognize that for animals that have a nervous system and who are particularly complex nervous systems like we have, to function, to identify, oh, that shape, reliably, I'm extracting the invariant features in that shape of curviness and yellowness and banana, even if I'm a hominid or a non-human primate, I can recognize that thing, okay? So there's a stable percept of the banana and then a fairly stable action plan to get the banana. You need to do that if you're going to stay alive and have babies who pass on their own genes. So on the one hand, experience is endlessly transient, ephemeral. As soon as it's there, it's gone. It's kind of freaky. As soon as it's there, it's changed. Okay? And yet, to survive, we have to pretend that some things are relatively stable. We have to create a useful lie in our mind that banana-ness is relatively static, relatively enduring, so we can do something with it, and that the next banana will kind of taste a lot like the current banana. So it's a useful lie. And it's fuzzy. It's like a fuzzy truth. But fundamentally, there's this tension that, and it's quite poignant actually, that to live and to survive, Mother Nature has evolved us to be driven to generate a functional, a useful delusion, a useful lie, that things actually are not impermanent, when in fact they truly are. And that tension actually, biologically, between the way reality actually is and what it takes to survive as an animal with a nervous system also creates a fair amount of dukkha. Okay. Now, it doesn't mean that we should do nothing about dukkha. We should do nothing about suffering. Like, for example, right now, I notice it's, for me at least, getting a little unpleasantly warm and stuffy in here. Anybody else? No? Me? So let's open a door, which might promote alertness for me as well as others. So it's okay to take action about things. But there's this wonderful term, actually, in Buddhism called dukkha-dukkha, suffering that we suffer. Right? Getting angry that you're sad. Right? Getting ashamed of being afraid. Getting irritated with yourself for getting irritated with yourself yet again. Right? And so it's okay. There's a certain amount of dukkha. It's not the entirety of our experience. There's inherently a certain amount of it. But if we get angry about it, or we fight it, or we suffer it, or we do more than simply try to address it as an issue, like getting the door to be open, then we suffer more. Okay. So it's useful to just finish on this second characteristic of existence, is to observe subtleties of contraction, discontent, uneasiness, as well as grosser forms of rage or terror or shame or depression or grief. Notice that on the full spectrum. And for many of us who have relatively comfortable lives compared to many people in the world today, and certainly we have much more comfortable lives, most of us, than people who lived in the Buddhist time, nonetheless, I grew up in LA near Beverly Hills in some ways, there's still a lot of neurotic suffering in the lives of people who are physically comfortable. So it's useful to kind of watch it arise, right? I talk about people in my life, especially my wife. She's long-suffering in that regard. And so we're having to fix a problem in our bathroom in our house because we had mold damage there. So now we have to replace and repair a lot of stuff. And some marriages don't survive a remodel. I think ours will. So you can just see stuff arising. And the Buddha has a lot of analysis, which we'll get into this year, of try to watch the kind of the mechanics of irritability or exasperation or positionality or resentment or grievance arise. It's very useful to truly watch your mind in real time and watch what causes suffering and what causes its end. It is said that the Buddha said he taught only one thing, suffering and its end. Now I think, well, that's two things. Wait a second here. But kind of put them together. So you think about it. He's basically saying, look, I'm paraphrasing. I'm putting words into his mouth. In effect, to me, he's saying, I became an expert on suffering and its causes. And I'm trying to offer to you what I've learned. So you will suffer less and cause less suffering for other people. I think that's the gist in a lot of ways. So become a student of suffering. I remember my friend and teacher, Gil Fronstall. I was just chatting with him about a year or two ago, and I asked him what he did in his own personal practice, primarily these days, and Gil's far along. He paused, and then he kind of smiled in a good-humored and kind of humble way. He said, well, I stopped for suffering. His own and other people. That's his practice. So stop for suffering. Study it. Understand it. And observe what causes it to increase and what helps cause it to decrease. That's mindfulness of the second characteristic of existence, dukkha. Okay. And then the third characteristic is perhaps the hardest to really talk about, partly because the topic that we're tending to talk about tends to pull up the delusion that we're talking about, which is the sense of self. This is the third characteristic, anatta, or not self, sometimes translated. This is the observation that can be described in different ways. One way to describe it is that any part of reality depends on all the other parts. I think John Muir had a nice quotation, to paraphrase closely. He said, when I look out, I see that everything is hitched to everything else. There's a metaphor in Hinduism, Indra's net, this vast network in which every body, every solar system, every atom, every bit of reality is like a node in a vast net of mirrors. And each mirror reflects all the other mirrors back to itself infinitely. So that's one way to understand the sense of anatta, which means, therefore, that our sense of being somehow independent of everything is a delusion, and that actually we are hitched truly to everything. That's one way to look at it. Another way to regard anatta is to observe in your own psychology. And very often what works to do it is with instant replay. Right, like these trick plays in the Super Bowl recently where you just watch them again and again. How did the Eagles do that? Right? Anyway, where you kind of look back and you rewind the last few seconds and you realize and you observe the sense of self, a sense of me or references to me or a sense of being an I inside looking out through the eyes. Okay. Or a sense of taking something personally. How could you treat me that way? Don't you know I'm special or something, right? You observe in your mind a sense of possessiveness, my precious and so forth. So, and then you just stop the video, the movie for the last few seconds and you look closely at it. And what you observe again and again and again is there are many representations of an I or a me, you know, a Rick inside here, or, you know, a you inside there. There are many representations of that. There are many presumptions that there's an entity in there. There's a stable entity, but you never find the stable entity itself. You just keep looking. And even when you observe those, the sense of self is an experience. It's a mental content, like a sound or a sight or a sensation. So you have the sense of self, and then you look closely. What's the nature of the sense of self as an experience? It's transient, it's made up of parts, and it's transient in the sense it increases and decreases, it's dynamic, and it arises based on causes, and it passes away based on causes. So it does not have any kind of absolute abiding self nature. Whoa. This can get very philosophical. It's much better to just keep bringing it down. And observe as well the suffering that is dependent upon the presumption of self. It's routinely taught that suffering is caused by selfing. Notice the way I'm languaging that as process. I think there's a lot of truth to that. But flip it around, what you'll often notice is that desire emerges first, or something painful emerges, or something related to another person emerges in your mind, and then on the heels of it, a second or two or ten later, is a growing sense of me, myself, and I. So much as selfing causes suffering, suffering causes selfing. You can see both of that in your mind. All right. So to finish on this third characteristic and then open it up, I think there are three ways to relate to or explore, as the Buddha taught, this sense of anatta. One is very psychological. He likened the self to a banana tree, which apparently if you unwrap the banana tree, you just keep unwrapping it, and eventually there you never find a core. There's no core to the banana tree. All right? So you look closely, there's a person. You're a person. There's continuity. This particular body, this particular mind, this particular history, there's a continuity of personness, much as there's a continuity of a standing wave in a river rising over a boulder, even though dynamically it's endlessly changing. And there's no essentialized essence to the standing wave. There's no essence to the standing wave that endures. You can't essentialize a standing wave. There's personing, but look closely, as the Buddha taught, is there actually a self in there? Okay, that's one way to look at it. Another way to relate to this is that we can increasingly understand and experience that we're a local expression of the whole cosmos, and as well including human culture, the ways that who we are depends so much on how we've been raised, the ways others have influenced us. We're a local knot in the vast tapestry of causes, tugged moment to moment by various threads pulling on us. That's another way. And the final way is perhaps the most radical of all, and it's kind of where the Buddha started. The psychological and the ecological, interdependent arising aspects came later, but his core teaching was that the presumption of his time that there was a soul essence that was eternal, he argued against. The original meaning of the word atta or atman in Hinduism is some kind of causelessly arising, endlessly, eternally enduring soul. And he argued that people clung to that notion in ways that created suffering, so he critiqued it. And in his own view, while there was an existent transcendental, the unconditioned, the eternal, the causeless, there was not a causelessly arising soul essence that was eternal. Whether that's true or not, that's a little above my pay grade, but I'm trying to pass along what the Buddha taught as best I can. Okay, so finishing up, the takeaway, and I'm trying to go through these 12 strengths this year, giving you a lot of straight up hardcore Dharma along the way. So we're going through that as well. We have the opportunity for benefit to ourselves and through us rippling out to other people to become more and more grounded, more and more mindful in a more and more embodied way of a real-time felt recognition of transience, the causes of suffering and the end of suffering, and a sense of being increasingly connected with everything and more peace about that. That's the opportunity. Okay. All right. Tofu balls. What do you think? What do you make of all this? Let's try to keep it experiential, too, because it's so easy to spin out. Yeah.
If there is no self, then who is to get angry when there's a narcissistic injury?
Right.
I didn't get a birthday card from my kid. Somebody cut me off in traffic.
Yeah.
I didn't get that promotion.
Yeah. Totally right.
So, second part.
Yeah.
And though there is injustice in the world, back to the metaphor of the work, I was passed over promotion because of blatant nepotism. Should I be angry?
Right. Yeah. So, these are fundamental questions. If you look closely, let's just pick one. So someone has affronted you or provoked you or devalued you genuinely, all right? So slow motion now, instant replay. What do you see when you observe your own experience? Especially if you do what the Buddha said, which is to disentangle the threads of it, okay? So they said the words, right? There was understanding, and then there was probably a cascade of reactions to it. Maybe initially shock, and then a sense of woundedness and hurt, maybe pulling up some history of similar injuries, right? And then perhaps while the seconds tick away, now we're about 2 seconds in, maybe five. In real time, you have a brain that's neurons are firing 5 to 50 times a second routinely. A lot can happen in a few seconds. Then there's a growing sense of outrage, of personalizing it, right? Okay. So when you watch it, what do you see? I suggest that we always see the same thing. We see an experience, a cascade of reactions that are made up of many parts, right? The nature of our reactions changes from reaction to reaction. And in those many parts, do you ever find an entity? Do you ever find, even the sense of me is made up of many parts. And then fairly quickly it all kind of passes away. So, right? That's kind of the nature of the experience. I'm putting words into your mouth kind of in the interest of time, but that's what I see and that's what people report. And so definitely experience is occurring. Persons are having experiences. Or more exactly, in persons, experiences are occurring dependently based on causes and conditions.
But I so enjoy the outrage.
Really? And then the question is, what happens when you start looking closely at that process of taking something personally? And you start with practice, repeatedly, mindfully, teasing apart its elements. For myself, at least, I climb down off my high horse a lot faster. And I'm a lot more effective in dealing with whatever needs to be dealt with. Persons have responsibilities. Persons have duties and rights. Persons have natural interests. Persons can have goals. Persons have values. Persons have aspects of them, little processes or subcomponents or capabilities that want to heal and repair and grow and accumulate insight. All that's happening, but does any of that require an I? That's a unified, enduring, and independent actor. It's not there's a right answer. It's as the Buddha taught, see for yourself again and again. What happens when you look really closely?
You're really asking us to go beyond the outrage, you know, to ask further questions.
Yeah.
And seek further.
And to look more closely. Yeah. And to slow it down, rewind it. What do you observe? Right? It's really interesting. There's a presumption of an I, but again and again, it's just one more content of consciousness. And what's interesting is that the sense of self, it's right, it's an experience. It's like a sound. It's not a problem that the sense of self arises. The problem is we privilege it. We make it special. It's one of the key things we make special in the mind. And as a detail, I do like a whole workshop all day long on this, and there are people who've spent their whole lives exploring this fundamental matter. It's a big thing, but one thing that is interesting, just to finish on this one, then hear from others, paradoxically, often through truly internalizing, narcissistic supplies, truly internalizing, feeling cherished and admired and approved of, loved, included, to the extent that it's true and healthy, really, really taking it in, you gradually fill that hole in your heart and you become less needy. And you become less narcissistically vulnerable, less caught up in your own story. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Anyway. Okay, great. Over here.
I just wanted to continue with this example. example of outrage or anger, you know, because what about, you know, what about awake people, awake masters? And there's lots of stories that they get angry, you know, and but I imagine or I sense that the anger in their case, there is no attachment anymore, you know. And it's like, you know, I just remember, you know, there was one story of Gurdjieff, you know, and he would get like totally angry, and then somebody came in and served him like whatever he was drinking. He was like an alcoholic, right? And he smiled at him, and he had just witnessed how he was so angry. So I just figure that it would be inhuman, you know, not to still have these feelings and emotions. I don't think that this is the way that we should imagine somebody who's awake. But the attachment isn't there, and it just goes quick.
Well, that was lovely, well said, really appreciate it. People have different ways of defining awakening and all that and so forth. And I don't want to say here that I know the right way to define it. I just want to acknowledge different ways of talking about it. And in, I think the roots of the Buddhist tradition, there was a very strong emphasis on morality and virtue and non-harming as foundational. And I think in the world today, we're aware of many examples of people who have great charisma and lots of realization. I had a teacher fundamentally for a while, for several years quite seriously, Adi Da, Da Frijan Lovananda. And man, he could transmit. There were times where it was like the stained glass window of his mind was transparent and wow, stuff came through. And there are many examples in the Buddhist tradition of very wise Zen masters and other teachers, and we can think of other traditions as well, who really can teach a lot and can really drop into very deep places, who also are alcoholic or who also routinely sexually abuse their students. And in, I think that, for me at least, would be inconsistent with the levels of awakening described in Buddhism, the four levels, which I should talk about another time, which culminate in the operational definition of full awakening in the Theravadin roots tradition of Buddhism. The arahant is one in whose mind no longer greed, hatred, or delusion can arise, or any sense of self. And I think, to your point, that's totally true. We have animal bodies that naturally drop a brick on the foot of a Buddha, it's going to hurt. And also, he sorrowed in his own life story when close friends of his died. So it's natural. And as a teacher of mine, Sylvia Borstein, said to me once, who would want to have a heart so equanimous as not to be moved by the suffering of another? 100% all that. On the other hand, I just think it's important to be careful about the slippery slope, which I'm sure you're aware of somehow cutting people slack who are actually acting out, as I think Adi Da was with his multiple wives and other people, acting out their own not entirely purified stuff. So that. But to your larger point, I think it's also completely true. And I'll finish on this point, maybe because it's a very powerful, to me, neat metaphor. It comes from Tibet. You may already know it. Apparently there they will heat iron stoves that are like skillets, that are pretty, really hot. They put a fire under them so the stove sits there. And of course in Tibet it snows a lot. So the image is that snowflakes fall, which is to say like pieces, bits and pieces, flotsam and jetsam in the stream of consciousness, thoughts, desires, and so forth. But the instant the snowflake touches the hot stove now is likened to the field of awareness, they are instantly self-liberated. Right? That's pretty wild. So I think that's where, to finish here, the steadiness of mind that I'll talk in the remaining talks this month of mindfulness I'll talk about, really enables us to stay increasingly right at the front edge of now. So that stuff arises, it does arise, and as you say, we release attachment to it continuously. And one way that I kind of operationalize my own path of development, and I see people who are farther along, is they're more and more in real time. So, and they're releasing more and more rapidly, and they're able to release bigger and bigger cred. Right? To the point eventually where they cultivate, and increasingly also they cultivate themselves so less and less cred arises. But even if it arises, it's instantly recognized. Empty of self, unfit to be clung to, transient, impersonally arising. Be here now. Okay, let's sit with that for a minute and finish tonight. I'll leave you with four words I took away from a retreat I did some years ago. Cling less, love more. Let's sit. Thank you very much. Hope to see you next week. Take care.